Hey, this is Paul Banas with GreatDad.com here with my weekly series talking to dads about all kinds of things, parenting and drugs and porn and many subjects, all trying to get the modern dad's perspective on what's going on with parenting today. And I'm excited to talk to my guest today, Stephen Rowley, Dr. Stephen Rowley. He's a psychotherapist and has a lot of experience with adoption. And not only was he adopted, but he has an adoptive son. Parents navigate this and how kids and, you know, growing adults navigate the fact that they were adopted. So welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So I'm first of all, interested in the fact that you became a psychotherapist relatively recently after a long history, career in education. So you've been working with kids for years and years, and this was your dream, you said, to get into psychotherapy. Tell me why that was a dream and why you finally decided to make the switch.
I start, for whatever reason, in my medium-sized hometown in Iowa, on the banks of the Mississippi, I started reading theologians and Freud, as a matter of fact. Now, I'm going to say I understood everything I was reading, but I was interested. And I think I would have pursued that, but then the 60s happened, and college campus at the University of Wisconsin was a wild and woolly time. And I think I felt more of a social obligation to go into something like education, to be a force for creating different kinds of schools. But that interest was always running parallel to everything I did in terms of what I was reading, who I was influenced by. It was not all Carl Jung, but certainly, Joseph Campbell, James Hillman, Carl Jung, James Hollis, people like that I already was familiar with. So when I went back to school and found myself, of course, the oldest person there, it was like more of a return to something. I jumped in and I'd already had academic experience. So it was kind of it was a romp through grad school at that age, but it was still fun. I got a lot out of that part. But then, as I described in my book, my own learning just sort of took off and went different directions. So I think maybe it's been my penchant throughout my life to be wary of orthodoxy, and including, what I find in myself sometimes and trying to shed that. So that independent thinking and being able to think for yourself and integrate in your own way all the knowledge and experience that we have, for me personally, it's an important deal.
Yeah, so let's talk about the book a little bit first, because I think I'm really curious as to how that, what you describe in the book, led to the Jungian philosophy and how that intersection. So the book is The Lost Coin, a memoir of adoption and destiny. It's a story. Well, maybe you should describe what the story is.
Right. I was always told from the beginning that I was, by my parents, I was adopted. Mm-hmm. I was born in a place called the Willows Maternity Sanitarium, which was Kansas City in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the hub in the United States for adoption. And there were a number of prominent homes for runaway mothers. The Willows was sort of the preeminent one. They advertised widely across on both coasts and got young women from all over the place. But I was only there for a short time. 10 days after I was born, I was taken to kind of almost like an infant boarding home until I was put in an adoption agency later at 6 months and then adopted by my parents. I bring that up because my 75th birthday was just about a month or so ago, and I was back in Kansas City with another partner who's a historian of the Willows Maternity Sanitarium, and we did a co-presentation, and the second one we did was at the Kansas City Library, only 2 miles from the original site of where I was born. It's very nostalgic there on my own birthday, and I make that point when I had my reunion with my mother, I asked her the question I said I dare not really needed to ask, is that, do you remember me on my birthday? We both teared up. Of course, the answer was yes. But the arc of the book is starts when I'm 13, and my mother, I expressed my interest in wanting to know more. She took that as an insult, and I flew into kind of a rage and shame and swore I'd never talk to her about it again. I never did, ever. The book shows some interesting twists and turns by the end of her life at age 101. But I said on my own, I had to wait to get to college to have my own mailing address and start. This is, of course, pre-internet days. So a letter writing to the adoption agency, kept trying to get records. So that quest went on for some time. I went through a couple of directors until I was in my 30s, and the new director, who is still alive and I've met twice the last year, gave me a little slip of paper with some non-sealed information that allowed me to find birth parents' names and the location of where my birth mother was from. So at that point, as I say in the book, the hunt was on. So it took some skullduggery to finally find out who she was, where she was. And when I did write her, the letter was intercepted by what Mike knew to me now, my half-sister, and said, we're not sure we can let you see her. We have to talk to her psychiatrist. And as it turned out, she had just been released from a halfway house. It was in state-sponsored housing. And I said, I'm coming regardless. If I have to stand across the street, I have to see her. So I came. And so the middle of the book, The Mother and Child Reunion, is about that reunion, which is I'm freshly minted from Stanford. I look like I dressed and had my hair cut in San Francisco. She was had been on the streets quite a bit, lost a lot of jobs due to drug and alcohol addiction. And you would think that person would have been appropriately disheveled and, you know, not much of a life. So after I got through the door, the first thing she said to me is, "What? I didn't tell you to come here. I didn't give you my address. Who gave you the right?" But as we got into it, she revealed almost nonchalantly that all her stuff was in storage. And she said she had a lot of books. I said, "How many do you have?" And she said, "Oh, 500 or so." Well, at that point, the lights went off in my head. Later, I was noticing a barren apartment. And she had one poster for the National Gallery. It was Kandinsky. Now, if actually, you can see where my finger is. I actually have a Kandinsky. Yeah. It's not the same one, but it's... So anyway, she then went into a recitation on Kandinsky's life and in that particular year of that painting and his transition from Russia into greater Europe and so forth. It was amazing. But then at some point, we had this kind of almost a Spock mind meld kind of a moment. And then I understood fully that she had been as desperately in search for me as much as I had been for her. And the sacrifice that her life represented, in a sense, to give me the life of great parents and so forth. So, and her life took a really negative turn, and she suffered greatly. After that weekend, I never saw her again. She died about 2 years after that. But that was the crowning moment, I think, of my life, really, one of the few. And I dare say for her, we had that reunion. We always, you know, here we are. We haven't seen each other since January 20th, 1949, and here we are. You know, I think it was, you know, New Year's Eve day, and, you know, 1988 or 89, I forget the year. So that's part of the arc. But underneath that is the arc of the whole quest for identity. Who am I? And so that persists as an issue in the book. And I think in my life, that kind of wrestling, as many of us do, who am I? How have I made myself? How has fate made me? Those are the kind of those imponderables, those intangibles that kind of I would claim in the book in a way happily haunt us. Because there's some things that we can't resolve. We can't come up with a calculus to say, here's the answer. But it's the mystery of that energy, to me, is very compelling. And I think it helps give a great deal of personal peace with that.
So you certainly hear this a lot from teens, that they feel like something is missing, that they've never connected with their mother or father. Sometimes it was one of the parents, they never got to know them. Sometimes it's because the mother or the father died at a very young age and they never have that experience. Is that universal among all people who lose a parent or do not have the original birth parents?
I don't think so. I think there's no poll on this, of course, no survey.
Right.
My guess is a big bell curve. There are some people like me more determined than ever to feel like something's missing, haunted by it, driven by it, want to know, got to know. Others who like don't have any interest whatsoever in knowing, don't want to pursue, don't want to know. Or in some cases, get down the road far enough and realize they're not supposed to know. Some people have ex-criminals for birth parents, or people might actually want to see us dead. So we're not supposed to know that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's interesting too, is the people who I guess live in the mystery and understand that or appreciate the mystery and just let it go, or the people who repress the drive to do it for whatever reason, either self-preservation. So I'm interested in whether that, the intersection too, the Jungian approach or what drew you to Jung is part of that search for wholeness, or is that, is the pursuit of the Jungian view, is that related to trying to, or maybe it's the usual desire to discover the self or to find the whole self?
I think there's several ways to answer that. One is that because the Jungian approach embraces the idea of the unconscious, we think of this idea of the separation of mother and child, which other people call, that I recount, as the primal wound. That wound is not something that's in our heads all the time. It's basically buried down in the unconscious. We may never understand it or know it, maybe know it exists. And for some people, don't care. So life's perfectly fine. Adoption was the best day of my life. Proceed. But for others, you have that other, the nature of that imprint and what it does in creating a kind of a yearning for connection, for wholeness. I said that if the adoption community had a theme song, it'd be Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. How does it feel to be a complete unknown, like a rolling stone, no direction home? That's not the quite order of those words, but you get what I mean. At that event in Kansas City, that crowd really resonated when I heard the people who were there, and who were like the graduates, many of us who came out of the Willows have that sort of in common, but not everybody. And I can't claim to say that's true, but I can say because these forces are unconscious, none of us can really know for sure exactly what it is, except we notice later in our life, our behavior. Sometimes we're haunted by a kind of vague sense of incompleteness. Sometimes we have a hard time making connections with relationships. Now, these are forms of trauma, and there are a lot of people who have written about trauma from a Jungian perspective. My particular niche on this is what I call developmental trauma. It's different than child sexual abuse or emotional abuse, or physical abuse. I mean, they're all forms of trauma, but this has a different kind of imprint, I think, in how what it sets up for us. That's not to say those who have experienced early childhood trauma of other kinds don't have some of those same characteristics. But again, it's a subtle and imaginative kind of prospect, if you will. Most psychotherapy generally is imagined. What's an ego? But we have that sense of it, that sense of the ineffable, just like the idea of collective unconscious. We can sort of define it, but you can't really conceptualize it in a concrete way. We have to know it through our other senses, like your intuition as an example. So that way of knowing on that level, I think, is what Carl Jung, among many other things, talks about, as did many of the people who followed him, is a way of understanding the world, a different way of seeing and knowing things that can't be calculated in an equation.
So how does that type of quest or desire for knowledge, or I guess we were talking a little bit earlier before we got on it, about the alienation that most people feel at times. Do you think that it is different, the adoptee lack of feeling of wholeness versus any other human beings who are also questing, that the adoptee has a name for it, has a reason for it, like a lot of other traumas would be?
I suppose in that way, but we're also part of the whole, right? So the things that you may be referring to more generally, you know, time of great anxiety in our world today, we may experience an alienation more from a Jungian perspective. We might call it a state of dissociation. There's a distance. And even though we feel at odds, that distance also is helping give us some protection by staying just a little away from it all. Otherwise, if we have no protection, then these things can be overwhelming. And for some people, they really can be. So
you think that it's similar but different? I'm not following how.
Well, I mean, one of the really interesting books, I can't remember the two authors' names, so one, Jonathan Haidt is one of them, The Coddling of the American Mind, a great book, and it recounts how from this generation, or the kids who are probably college application age time, at age 13 or so, were the first kids with iPhones in their hand. And this beginning of where, on one hand, we're supposed to be more connected, but in fact, we're less connected. And we have their parents, who are probably now in their 40s, traumatized by the Twin Towers and other things, uber protection for the kids. That's hence their argument is that's why we on college campuses, we have to have safe zones. We have to have any kind of threatening language or images that some might label as racist or controversial have to be taken away. So that sense of like, you know, the world is dangerous and you need to stay away from it. That sense of alienation has been cultivated by a parent generation on today's younger generation. So that's why we have people who are really kind of, it's a hypervigilance. And so we clearly know that more social media is not a cure for it at all. It takes you down some pretty negative roads. But I think even for those parents, that sense of something's not quite right and I've got to protect it, even though I can't put my finger on it. In 1957, when I would have been probably, I would have been early elementary, maybe kindergarten age, whatever year it was back in the 50s, the readiness standards for kindergarten, unlike today, which are mostly academic, you know, your numbers, you know, can you add, subtract, you know, your letters and so forth. One of the criteria back then was, could you drop your child off 4 blocks from your house? Can they walk home on their own? Hmm. Now, today, we've known of cases where people have been arrested for letting
their kids. Right, exactly, yeah.
But that sense of like, it's impossible. I mean, we couldn't have a kid 5 years old, 6 years old, walking by themselves 4 blocks. It's dangerous. Now, most kids could do it. But that sense, that parent sense of anxiety around it, this is what this age of anxiety we're living in, which I think manifests in different ways. You mentioned when we talked earlier about the sense of the other, you know, the person, I don't know who you are, but I know I don't like you. Or the people I don't know are a threat to me, whether they're people of color, certain religion, certain gender identity. Everybody's the other, and if they are, then they must be the enemy, and we've got to do what we can
but
to
kill
them.
But we're the other, too. Don't you think that's
we're the other, too.
Right.
We're the other, too, for many other people.
Well, no, even for we self-define as the other. And that's, I guess, really a lot of my curiosity is how distinct is the adoptee perspective and that lack of wholeness different than another perspective of being, like I told you, my kids are biracial and they have a different view right. of themselves and their place in the world, even though they've grown up in my world. And it's hard for me to distinguish whether that's a basic reason for being other, or is that self-imposed?
I think I'm going to try to contrast what I think I hear you saying. One is sort of the generalized anxiety, set of alienation of our times. And right. the other is when people, including adoption, but other forms of early childhood trauma, create that imprint. That psychic imprint is a definite, and it's not so much the event, it's our response to it is we're charged with it. And it creates a lot of kind of different mysteries. Why when three soldiers see one buddy killed up by a landmine, that two of them, although they grieve, basically can go back home and lead relatively normal lives. And others, the other one will go off the rails. Alcohol, drug addiction, domestic abuse, suicide, those kind of things. Now, they saw the same event, but the response to it very different. So, but I'd say that was the whole trauma and trauma on the soul, trauma on the psyche, that imprint, that invisible imprint, is a distinction from sort of rest of the population. Now, that said, I dare say that if everybody's skin turned blue who had some form of childhood trauma of some kind before age 10, there'd be a lot of blue people walking around. We just don't know it.
Yeah.
We just don't know it.
Yeah.
And it takes, well, for that matter, we don't wear adoption badges. We don't say, here's my,
right.
my calling card. So it's common since I've been with the book and publicity and so forth, where I'm in groups, 5, 6, 7 people. I ask, how many people here have been adopted, parent of an adoptee, or know somebody who's been adopted? I'd say routinely 3 out of 7 will say yes to that. Yeah. So the numbers, some books calculate the actual number of people who are formally adopted in this country, about 1.5 million. Those who were raised, if you include those who were raised by somebody other than their biological parent or foster upbringing, that number goes to 10 million. But those who have been affected in some way by adoption or know of adoption, that number goes up to 100 million. So there's way more of it out there than we think, but it's just not something when you have guests over for a party, you don't check them for their ID and you don't check them with their adoption status is, but it's there.
So I know for long years, maybe before your birth, there was a lot of people were told not to tell adoptee kids that they were adopted and to pretend as if they were part of the family. And maybe this is a very difficult question, but do you think your feelings of lack of wholeness or your search, which end up you writing a book, I mean, is obviously a very important part of your life, would have been different had you been blissfully unaware and just grown up with your parents? You think you would have
Well, it would have been an obvious giveaway. Something wasn't right because I didn't look like my parents. In fact, there's a great book by Dani Shapiro called Inheritance about her discovery. Her parents were Jewish, I think, Orthodox, Ashkenazi Jews, something. So they all look Jewish, dark hair, dark eyes, and she is blonde, blue-eyed, and devout into the religion, and way into her later age, but she kept meeting people in college that go, you're not Jewish. She goes, yes, I am. I go observe the Sabbath. I'm in it full tilt.
Right.
It wasn't until later that her mom spilled the beans after her dad had died that she was actually a product of a sperm donor. And that suddenly made sense. And when she found him, which I think actually is here in Seattle, she doesn't say so. But anyway, when she saw him and realized her husband saw him on YouTube, he's a doctor with some repute, a researcher, same color hair, same hand gestures, same way of reading.
Yeah,
that's where you kind of go, wow, that's where you really know where the connection is. And when she met him, he didn't try to be the father she'd never had or the real father, nor did she try to be the daughter, although she became really good friends with his own daughters. But that special relationship and how, in their case, or in my case, how we're drawn into these relationships by faith. So I was totally faithful in a lucky way to have, an affluent upbringing, supportive parents, loving parents. So my sense of incompleteness was not a raving problem. It wasn't, I was the all-American boy when I was growing up and had nothing but good luck and had good education along the way. But it's sort of it's a subtle sense in the beginning. You can't even have words for it. And as I got older, get more into the reading in my profession, I understood more clearly what it was. And so that's why writing this book is to try to help put a little bit more definition for, at least for some people's experience. So it's a little more intelligible and from of their own experience. So I'd say from the groups I've talked with and individual I've met, I say generally that's been recognized, solidly recognized. But I was like, so yeah, that's me. Oh yeah. I always wondered, now I know.
Yeah, I wonder if there's something unconscious going on in most of us. Like, I wouldn't necessarily that I am like my mother, like my father, but other people externally can see that. And I wonder if unconsciously I'm, you know, I'm checking those boxes or seeing them internally, yeah. Whereas other people externally can say, yeah, you walk like him or you talk like him or you cut your food like him, you know, all those things that other right. people could see, but you can't, but maybe you do experience unconsciously.
But it's, yes, and but it's also true of the people who are absolutely the biological product of their parents about, you know, still have that feeling sometime, like I'm not like my family at all.
Yeah. Well, that's my question about alienation and the existential feeling, you know, of belonging to anything and how we reconcile that with.
Yeah, it puts into question something that's unanswerable, and that is, yeah. But we know that the nuclear family is a rare commodity, number one, but what are families anyway? I mean, yeah. In terms of some people are devoted to family, everything is about family,
right.
All the celebrations, the holidays, big extent, my birth father's four daughters, my half sisters who I met 2 years ago, they have a really one of those great family trees. You know, they've got aunts and uncles and cousins and, you know, on and on, real solid. And for them, family is, I think, everything. And for other people, it's just simply not. Or there's plenty of people who simply don't get along with their brother or sister and think somehow it's wrong because they are the brother and sister, when yeah. In fact, there's no logical reasons they need to maintain a relationship. So it's all we're all over the map in that way.
So what advice do you have for adoptive parents in terms of what things should they know about this? Because sometimes you hear horror stories about people who really wanted to do the right thing and they experience complete alienation by their adoptive kids. And I'm sure they blame themselves. They think they should have done something differently. And sometimes just the way it works. But are there things that adoptive parents should know or should do?
So, yeah, I think I have strong feelings that the kids from their earliest age should be told, as I was, that they were adopted. And as I was, luckily, my parents build it into the story of like, we chose you. You know, we wanted you. Now, what do we say about the other kids? You know, we wanted them too, but you know, and whatever they know or feel like it's appropriate to tell, they begin to render their adoption story. And until a kid's old enough, if they hear it enough, that's fine. But when they get to a certain age, let's say early teens, it's important for them to have their own memories and develop their own story. And it doesn't have to be the same story that mom and dad have. So that sense of my own narrative, taking charge of that is an important thing. And that can sometimes make parents feel a little crosswise when the kid starts to say, yeah, I love you, but I still want to know who they were. Or in some cases, when they've met that person in their parents' lifetime, being big enough, so to speak, to allow that in that's their kid's reality. It's their reality. So when a newly discovered step-birth parent comes in the picture, I think the adopted parent can only but continue to embrace the kid and say, this is part of your experience. Don't explain why, but this is part of the world you're in, and this is how fate, and we're still here, and we're still loving, and it doesn't change a thing for us. So that reinforcement of who you are, you know, as opposed to your ours, who you are. I mean, you want to say both, but it's not ownership. But I think that can be reassuring in time, where a kid feels like they have some degree of control of their own identity, and they're not made to subscribe and salute to just the family name and just only to loyalty to the adopted parents as though they owe them something. Well, typically, I think we do, but not to the point where it begins to restrict and try to sponge out conflicting realities or different rivals in some cases. So what else? I think, of course, the whole thing, which is goes without saying with any kind of parenting, is that it's a challenge, I think, for parents to, easy to say, hard to do, is the idea of unconditional love, that it doesn't matter, even though we don't look alike, we don't might have the same taste. We like to do these things, you know, mom and dad do, or maybe other kids that came to the family later, you're a little different. Embrace all of that. Embrace the difference that they are, and as a celebration of who they are, rather than trying to, you know, design a future script for the kid that they'll be loved and follow the script. And that's so clearly a mistake, and that can be a mistake in anything. It's really hard to say without the specifics about how to raise a healthy kid. And I think to make them feel like, yeah, you're adopted, and yet we're doing whatever you don't necessarily have to highlight it all the time, but there should be that kind of on the side. that particular story. Now, it's a different thing, I think, when we come to open adoptions, because I do have fairly strong feelings about that. I know it's much more popular, considered, trendy. I mean, it's been around for a while, but almost somehow politically correct to have an open adoption. If you're opposed to an open adoption, there's something wrong with you. Out of my own experience, and this is now speaking also as a psychotherapist, I think it's really important to let up to a certain age, say 18, arbitrary and understandably, is to let the kid have their own identity for a while and let them grow up as with both parents or even a single parent as them. And then after at age 18, if when records can be released, then it's a good time to let the other people into, if they're wanting to, enter into their lives. You're much more able to, your sense of who you are is much more established. It's, you become mature. I worry about kids who are 7 and 8. It's hard enough to be even in a divorced family, let alone like, well, I live with you and I call you mom, but you're mom too. And sometimes they book a Marine right now. Actually, she's from UC San Francisco. Dr. Gretchen Sisson, S-I-S-O-N, on Relinquished, talking about this problem of sometimes, not always, of open adoptees who want to have a baby, can't hold them, but they want to have it both ways. I want to give you my baby, but I still want to be mother in kind of an ancillary role. I want to, you know, be in the, what do they call the sidecar into the family. Sometimes I have to believe that works. Other times it has a way of going sideways. In other words, there's a dependence created by that other person who's not a full-fledged parent. It's sort of like Fritz Perls used to say, should or get off the pot. It's either be a full-time parent or don't be. And not forever, but for a time that's in the interest of the kid, not the interest of the adult.
I think that would cause a lot of questions about loyalty and trust if you don't know who it is. And it's difficult enough for the adoptive parent to make sure they transmit the fact that they have the same, even though it's not a physical bond, that they have that same trust and bond that a biological parent would have, and be right, convincing and supporting that all right, the time. And if somebody else comes in, that would upset that. So how about adoptees as they go through that journey, or maybe, you know, around adolescence, they start wondering how this all works. Do you advise people to do a deeper dive, or are there things that they should do to make sure that they are as whole as can be?
I wouldn't advise somebody to do more than what they feel they can want to do. I would recognize and honor curiosity. And that might be, you know, the full meal deal. It might just simply be that. It might be, I'm curious, I don't want to do more. Our son does not have that kind of curiosity. I mean, I think there are other reasons for that. And I'm not judging him. Nor have I really, particularly both as a dad and psychotherapist, in dangerous territory to start asking these kind of questions. But I respect that he doesn't want to know more. And I think we have some reason why. I mean, he knows the basics. My wife and he and I actually met his birth father when he was about 9 years old, just for a day. Was enough. And so he has a rough knowledge of that, but he doesn't want to know more. Great. I mean, why go looking for trouble? Why go looking in places that might yield nothing more than heartache? And I don't know that for a fact, but I think it's both of his birth parents have very complicated circumstances. And neither of them are alive, but there are family members left on one side. So I think if he were determined, he would, but he's, even after my book, it hasn't raised any more questions, at least around me. And I don't think with his mother or anybody else either. So he's just, and that's why I say everybody's response to it is very different. Yeah, I wouldn't expect him to do more than he's doing.
Yeah, it just seems like we all have so many mysteries, and the families quite often have a lot of mysteries that are never told. And certainly now some of those are coming to the fore with 23andMe and other ways that people discover things along the way. But families have many mysteries that we'll never know. And it's hard to know. Really, it's hard to really discover the mystery of the soul unless you work with a therapist and really dig deep. And
even I have a client who's, he was born in Colombia and his two adopted daughters were born there in Medellin. But only recently through 23andMe did he get in contact with relatives of some kind. I think he knew from some of the early stories that when he was born, he was taken out of the delivery room and given to a white family up here in the Northwest. And birth mother was told that he had died and whisked out of town, didn't know why. And as he then, through these later contacts, 23andMe, who also are, I think, are roughly cousins, second cousins from Colombia. As we were talking about all this stuff, I just had this feeling, because we talked, you know, you could be a criminal, who knows? I did Wikipedia on Pablo Escobar, and my client and him at age 38, could have been twins. Now, I don't think, nor does he think Escobar was the birth father, but you don't never know. But somebody of a high authority represented a clear threat of life to him and his birth mother. And so he's going back with these other relatives. I mean, but it's a little treacherous. There's still some other secrets that people don't want to tell him. So sometimes you're not supposed to know. And sometimes you just have to take no as no. And or sometimes this knowledge comes much later in life, as you mentioned earlier, complete surprise. I have a classmate from high school, I think not until recently, fully appreciated and realized that her sister was her mother, not her mother. Yeah. And they're much older. That came as a surprise. There was another guy on one of the podcasts who was telling me about when he was his 30th class reunion, a girl came over to him from his class and said, you know, I've always wanted to know, what was it like to be adopted? And he had no clue. I think the whole town knew except him.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of these surprise ones. Sometimes they're happy, sometimes they're not very happy.
Well, what's I find so intriguing about that is how different people react differently. Like, as you say, some people are just like, oh, that's an interesting factoid, and they just go on with their day. And for other people, it would be just like, oh, now you've destroyed my whole life story, right? Worldview, and you know, I'm confused.
Yeah, it's not that uncommon for us to know people who were raised by a grandmother or an older sister or a friend of the family or whatever we may call them. Sure. Seems, you know, there's a lot of famous people. I'm thinking of John Lennon and Eric Clapton, both were raised by grandmothers and so forth. Right. And the real mother was around, and the other, but when you start digging there, where was the father, where was the mother? It's, you know, that's, you're better off with the grandma and just let the past lie like a sleeping dog in the court.
Well, this is really fascinating. I really like to dig in a lot deeper. It's something that I don't know a lot about, but like you say, I'm among the 100 million or who've got personal experience or other experiences with adoptees. And every time I hear the story, it's both heartbreaking and really intriguing how their different reactions. Because like we said, sometimes it's very emotional and other times it's like, that was then and I've got my life.
Like I said, it's a big bell curve out there, I think.
Yeah. So you've got a website, StephenRowley108.com, mm-hmm. where you have links to the book, of course. But I did ask you earlier whether you do take clients. You can only practice in Washington State, but you deal with a lot of different people, teenagers and adults, and some of them are adoptees.
Yeah, it's a different thing about talking about advice and help with a certain problem that doesn't sort of stray into therapy. I also have Coach Strang from San Rafael. So I have that in my background, but no, there's things I would call coaching that isn't really psychotherapy. And if I find myself drifting in, I have to say, well, now we're getting to therapy. I really have to back out of it. I think that's not what people are looking for, but I think deeper understanding about themselves and the adoption world is not necessarily, you know, they may look a little parallel, but they're not really the same as going into a deep dive as it would in therapy. So yeah, I'm available for sure.
Yeah. Having done therapy, there's certainly a time in your life, even if you're not in crisis, where digging deep into some of those questions that you only ask yourself at 4 a.m. when you're awake, or, you know, the things that you know right. are nagging at you, even if hasn't led to huge problems, is, you know, part of the journey in trying to understand what we're doing
right.
here. And if you have the resources to be able to do something with somebody with your kind of training and background, I really advise people to take advantage of that. It is a gift of knowing yourself in a way that obviously nobody else can.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So the book is The Lost Coin, a memoir of adoption and destiny. And you can find that on Amazon as well as other places, including StephenRowley108.com. I'd be interested to know what the 108 is from. But we'll put that in the show notes as well.
That's one of those Buddhist things.
Okay, great. Yeah, that we could have talked about the Buddhist thing as a whole other segment. We will do that another time.
Okay.
Well, the question I'd be interested in is how the adoption process affects resilience. But I think we've kind of talked about how it has an effect on some people and does not have an effect on others.
A very short answer to your question is that the resilience is essentially the capacity to, I think, withstand the normal ups and downs, although they may be extreme, of ups and downs of life, and kind of get through them, survive them, learn from them, take from them.
Right.
So that we're not either fearful of it or not taken down by it, overwhelmed by it, but have a way persistently at our own time and pace to go through these things with a full knowledge. I don't know exactly what I'm getting myself into. I can't predict the outcome. It's like they say about baseball. If it wasn't hard, everybody would do it. So you got to have, particularly up here in Seattle. But anyway, and the same with the Giants are not doing so well either. So anyway, yeah, that's that would define, there's all manner of people written about resilience, but that's a kind of It's like a lung, kind of. It breathes in and out. It has that sort of central essence that is able to withstand ups and downs. And I learn how to take the hidden gifts that are often hiding in places where we least expect them, or the darkest places. That's where the work of therapy really comes into, because we go through some pretty negative stuff. You know, if you had a horrible upbringing, well, you can't erase that, but you can't, you know, you'll be cursed to live life as a victim. So how do we go back and say, what could possibly be okay with the bad thing, stuff that happens to me? And I can guarantee that you can always find it if we just persistent enough.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Stephen.
Thank you, Paul.
For people who are interested in building more of that resilience, I do lead a course if you're interested in how to develop unshakable resilience in the face of everyday challenges as a science-based program. And if you're interested, anybody's interested in talking to me, please reach out and I'll be happy to tell you about that. Okay, so until next time, Paul Vance, thegreatdad.com. Thanks a lot, Stephen Relly.
Thank you. Bye-bye.